the wild palms. The knocking sounded again, at once discreet and peremptory, while the doctor was descending the stairs, the flashlight's beam lancing on before him down the brown-stained stairwell and into the brown-stained tongue-and-groove box of the lower hall. It was a beach cottage, even though of two stories, and lighted by oil lamps, or an oil lamp, which his wife had carried upstairs with them after supper. And the doctor wore a nightshirt, too, not pajamas, for the same reason that he smoked the pipe which he had never learned and knew that he would never learn to like, between the occasional cigar which clients gave him in the intervals of Sundays on which he smoked the three cigars, which he felt he could buy for himself, even though he owned the beach cottage as well as the one next door to it, and the one, the residence with electricity and plastered walls, in the village 4 miles away. Because he was now 48 years old, and he had been 16 and 18 and 20 at the time when his father could tell him, and he believe it, that cigarettes and pajamas were for dudes and women. It was after midnight, though not much. He could tell that, even apart from the wind, the taste and smell and feel of wind, even here, behind the closed and locked doors and shutters, because he had been born here, on this coast, though not in this house, but in the other, the residence in town, and had lived here all his life, including the 4 years at the State University's medical school and the 2 years as an intern in New Orleans, where a thick man, even when young, with thick, soft woman's hands, who should never have been a doctor at all, who even after the 6 more or less metropolitan years, looked out from a provincial and insulated amazement at his classmates and fellows, the lean young men swaggering their drill jackets, on which, to him, they wore the myriad anonymous faces of the probationer nurses with a ruthless and assured braggadocio, like decorations, like flower trophies. He had sickened for it. So he graduated, nearer the foot of the class than the head, though not at either, and came home, and within the year married the wife his father had picked out for him, and within 4 years owned the house which his father had built, and assumed the practice which his father had created, losing nothing from it and adding nothing to it, and within 10 years owned not only the beach house where he and his wife spent their childless summers, but the adjoining property as well, which he rented to summer visitors or even parties, picnickers or fishermen. On the evening of the wedding, he and his wife went to New Orleans and spent 2 days in a hotel room, though they never had a honeymoon. And though they had slept in the same bed for 23 years now, they still had no children. But even apart from the wind, he could still tell the approximate time by the staling smell of gumbo, now cold in the big earthen pot on the cold stove beyond the flimsy kitchen wall. The big pot of it which his wife had made that morning in order to send some over to their neighbors and renters in the next house. The man and the woman who 4 days ago had rented the cottage, and who probably did not even know that the donors of the gumbo were not only neighbors, but landlords, too. The dark-haired woman, with queer, hard, yellow eyes in a face whose skin was drawn thin over prominent cheekbones and a heavy jaw. The doctor called it sullen at first, then he called it afraid. Young, who sat all day long in a new, cheap beach chair facing the water, in a worn sweater and a pair of faded jean pants and canvas shoes, not reading, not doing anything, just sitting there in that complete immobility which the doctor, or the doctor in the doctor, did not need the corroboration of the drawn quality of the skin and the blank, inverted fixity of the apparently unseeing eyes to recognize at once. That complete immobile abstraction from which even pain and terror are absent, in which a living creature seems to listen to and even watch some of its own flagging organs, the heart, say, the secret irreparable seeping of blood. And the man, young, too, in a pair of disreputable khaki slacks and a sleeveless jersey undershirt, and no hat, in a region where even young people believed the summer sun to be fatal. Seen usually walking barefoot along the beach at tide edge, returning with a faggot of driftwood strapped into a belt, passing the immobile woman in the beach chair with no sign from her, no movement of the head, or perhaps even of the eyes. But it was not the heart, the doctor told himself. He decided that on the first day, from where, without intending to eavesdrop, he watched the woman through the screen of oleander bushes which separated the two lots. Yet this very postulation of what it was not seemed to him to contain the secret, the answer. It seemed to him that he saw the truth already, the shadowy, indefinite shape of truth, as though he were separated from the truth only by a veil, just as he was separated from the living woman by the screen of oleander leaves. He was not eavesdropping, not spying. Perhaps he thought, I will have plenty of time in which to learn just which organ it is she is listening to. They have paid their rent for 2 weeks. Perhaps at that time also the doctor in the doctor, knowing that it would not require weeks, but just days. Thinking how if she should need assistance it would be fortunate that he, the landlord, was also a doctor, until it occurred to him that since they probably did not even know he was the landlord, they would probably not know either that he was a doctor. The real estate agent told him over the telephone of the renting of the house. She's got on pants, the agent said. I mean, not these ladies' slacks, but pants. Man's pants. I mean, they are too little for her in just exactly the right places any man would want to see them too little, but no woman would, unless she had them on herself. I reckon Miss Martha ain't going to like that much. That will be all right with her if they pay their rent on time, the doctor said. No damn fear, the agent said. I saw to that. I ain't been in this business this long for nothing. I said, it will have to be in advance. And he said, all right, how much? Like he was Vanderbilt or somebody, in them dirty fishing pants and nothing but an undershirt under his coat. Hauling the wad of money out, and one of the bills wasn't but a 10, and I just gave him 10 change back out of the other one, and there wasn't but 2 of them to begin with, and I says, of course, if you want to take the house like it is, with just what furniture is in it now, you can get out pretty cheap. And he says, all right, how much? I believe I could have got more than I did, because if you ask me, he don't want any furniture. All he wants is 4 walls to get inside of and a door to close afterward. She never even got out of the taxi. She just sat there, waiting, in them pants that was just exactly too little for her in just exactly the right places. The voice ceased. The doctor's head filled now with suspended wire hum, the rising inflection of a risible silence, so that he said almost sharply, "Well, do they want more furniture or not? There's nothing in the house but one bed, and the mattress on it ain't—" "No, no, they don't want any more. I told him the house had a bed and a stove in it, and they had a chair with them, one of these canvas ones that fold up in the taxi along with the grip. So they're all fixed." Now that suspension of silent laughing filled the doctor's head again. "Well," the doctor said, "what is it? What's the matter with you?" Though he seemed to know already, before the other spoke, what the voice would say. "I reckon Miss Martha is going to have something that will set heavier on her stomach than them pants, even. I don't think they are married. Oh, he says they are, and I don't think he is lying about her, and maybe he ain't even lying about himself. The trouble is, they ain't married to each other. She ain't married to him. Because I can smell a husband. Show me a woman I never saw before on the streets of Mobile or New Orleans, either, and I can smell whether—" They took possession that afternoon of the cottage, the shack, which contained the one bed whose springs and mattress were not very good, and the stove with its one frying pan encrusted by generations of cooking fish, and the coffee pot, and the meager collection of mismatched iron spoons and forks and knives and cracked cups and saucers and drinking vessels which had once been containers of bought jams and jellies, and the new beach chair in which the woman lay all day long, apparently watching the palm fronds clashing with their wild, dry, bitter sound against the bright glitter of the water while the man carried driftwood into the kitchen. 2 mornings ago, the milk wagon, which made the beach route, stopped there, and the doctor's wife saw the man once returning up the beach from a small grocery store owned by a Portuguese ex-fisherman, carrying a loaf of bread and a bulky paper sack. And she told the doctor about watching him cleaning, or trying to clean, a mess of fish at the kitchen steps. Told the doctor about it with bitter and outraged conviction. A shapeless woman, yet not fat, not anywhere near as plump as the doctor himself, who had begun to turn gray all over about 10 years ago, as if hair and complexion both were being subtly altered, along with the shade of her eyes, by the color of the house dresses which she apparently chose to match them. "And a mess of it he was making," she cried. "A mess outside the kitchen and a mess on the stove, too, probably." "Maybe she can cook," the doctor said mildly. "Where? How? Sitting out there in the yard, when he carries stove and all out to her." But even that was not the real outrage, though she did not say so. She did not say, "They are not married," though it was in both their minds. They both knew that once it was said aloud between them, he would turn the renters out. Yet they both refused to say it, and for more reason than because when he turned them out, he would feel conscience-bound to return the rent money. More than this on his part, anyway, who was thinking, "They had only $20, and that was 3 days ago, and there is something wrong with her." The doctor, now speaking louder than the provincial Protestant, the Baptist-born. And something, perhaps the doctor here too, talking louder than the provincial Baptist in her too, because this morning she waked the doctor, calling him from the window where she stood shapeless in the cotton nightgown shaped like a shroud, and with her gray hair screwed into papers, to show him the man coming up the beach at sunrise with his belted faggot of driftwood. And when he, the doctor, came home at noon, she had the gumbo made, an enormous quantity of it, enough for a dozen people, made with that grim Samaritan husbandry of good women. As if she took a grim and vindictive and masochistic pleasure in the fact that the Samaritan deed would be performed at the price of its remainder, which would sit, invincible and inexhaustible on the stove, while days accumulated and passed, to be warmed and rewarmed and then rewarmed, until consumed by two people who did not even like it, who, born and bred in sight of the sea, had for taste in fish a predilection for the tuna, the salmon, the sardines bought in cans, immolated and embalmed 3,000 miles away in the oil of machinery and commerce. He delivered the bowl himself, a shortish, fattish, untidy man, with linen not quite fresh, sidling a little clumsily through the oleander hedge with the bowl covered by a yet creased and not yet even laundered, it was that new, linen napkin, lending an air of awkward kindliness even to the symbol which he carried of the uncompromising Christian deed, performed not with sincerity or pity, but through duty, and lowered it. She had not risen from the chair, nor moved, save the hard cat's eyes, as if the bowl contained nitroglycerin, the fattish, unshaven mask beaming foolishly, but behind the mask the eyes of the doctor within the doctor, shrewd, missing nothing, examining without smiling and without diffidence the face of the woman, who was not thin but actually gaunt, thinking, "Yes, a degree or two, perhaps three, but not the heart." Then, waking, rousing to find the blank, feral eyes staring at him, whom to his certain knowledge they could scarcely have seen before, with profound and illimitable hatred. It was quite impersonal, as when the person in whom joy already exists looks out at any post or tree with pleasure and happiness. He, the doctor, was without vanity. It was not at him the hatred was directed. "It's at the whole human race," he thought. "Or no, no, wait, wait." The veil about to break, the cogs of deduction about to mesh. Not at the race of mankind, but at the race of man, the masculine. But why? Why? His wife would have noticed the faint mark of the absent wedding ring, but he, the doctor, saw more than that. "She has borne children," he thought. "One, anyway. I would stake my degree on that. And if Kofer," he was the agent, "is right about his not being her husband, and he should be able to tell, smell, as he says, since he is apparently in the business of renting beach cottages for the same reason or under the same compulsion, vicarious need, which drives certain people in the cities to equip and supply rooms to clandestine and fictitious names. Say she had come to hate the race of men enough to desert husband and children. Good. Yet to have gone not only to another man, but to live apparently in penury, and herself sick, really sick, or to have deserted husband and children for another man and poverty, and then to have... He could feel, hear them, the cogs clicking, going fast. He felt a need for terrific haste in order to keep up, a premonition that the final cog would click and the bell of comprehension ring, and he would not be quite near enough to see and hear. Yes. Yes. What is it that man as a race can have done to her, that she would look upon such a manifestation of it as I, whom she has never seen before, and would not look at twice if she had, with that same hatred through which he must walk each time he comes up from the beach with an armful of firewood to cook the very food which she eats. She did not even offer to take the dish from him. "It's not soup, it's gumbo," he said. "My wife made it. We... She did not move. Looking at him as he stooped fatly in his crumpled seersucker with the careful tray, he did not even hear the man until she spoke to him. "Thanks," she said. "Take it into the house, Harry." Now she was not even looking at the doctor anymore. "Thank your wife," she said. He was thinking about his two tenants as he descended the stairs behind the jerking pencil of light into the staling odor of gumbo in the lower hall, toward the door, the knocking. It was from no presentiment, premonition, that the knocker was the man named Harry. It was because he had thought of nothing else for 4 days, this snuffy, middle-aging man in the archaic sleeping garment, now become one of the national props of comedy, roused from slumber in the stale bed of his childless wife, and already thinking of, perhaps having been dreaming of, the profound and distracted blaze of objectless hatred in the strange woman's eyes, and he again with that sense of imminence, of being just beyond a veil from something, of groping just without the veil, and even touching, but not quite, almost seeing, but not quite, the shape of truth, so that without being aware of it, he stopped dead on the stairs in his old-fashioned list slippers, thinking swiftly, "Yes, yes, something which the entire race of men, males, has done to her, or she believes has done to her." The knocking came again now, as if the knocker had become aware that he had stopped through some alteration of the torch's beam seen beneath the door itself, and now began to knock again with that diffident insistence of a stranger seeking aid late at night. And the doctor moved again, not in response to the renewed knocking, who had had no presentiment, but as though the renewal of the knocking had merely coincided with the recurrent, old, stale impasse of the 4 days' bafflement and groping, capitulant and recapitulant, as though instinct perhaps moved him again, the body capable of motion, not the intellect, believing that physical advancement might bring him nearer the veil at the instant when it would part and reveal in inviolable isolation that truth which he almost touched. So it was without premonition that he opened the door and peered out, bringing the torch's beam on the knocker. It was the man called Harry. He stood there in the darkness, in the strong, steady sea wind filled with the dry clashing of invisible palm fronds, as the doctor had always seen him, in the soiled ducks and the sleeveless undershirt, murmuring the conventional amenities about the hour and the need, asking to use the telephone, while the doctor, his nightshirt streaming about his flabby calves, peered at the caller and thought in a fierce surge of triumph, "Now I am going to find out what it is." "Yes," he said, "you won't need the telephone. I am a doctor myself."
"Oh," the other said, "can you come at once?"
"Yes, just let me slip on my pants. What's the trouble, so I shall know what to bring?" For an instant the other hesitated, this familiar to the doctor, too, who had seen it before and believed he knew its source, that innate and ineradicable instinct of mankind to attempt to conceal some of the truth, even from the doctor or lawyer for whose skill and knowledge they are paying.
"She's bleeding," he said. "What will your fee?"
But the doctor did not notice this. He was talking to himself.
"Ah, yes. Why didn't I... Lungs, of course. Why didn't I think of that?"
"Yes," he said. "Will you wait here? Or perhaps inside? I won't be but a minute."
"I'll wait here," the other said.
But the doctor did not hear that either. He was already running back up the stairs. He trotted into the bedroom where his wife rose on one elbow in the bed and watched him struggle into his trousers, his shadow, cast by the lamp on the low table by the bed, antic on the wall, her shadow also monstrous, gorgon-like from the rigid paper-wrapped twists of gray hair above the gray face, above the high-necked nightdress, which also looked gray, as if every garment she owned had partaken of that grim iron color of her implacable and invincible morality, which the doctor was to realize later was almost omniscient.
"Yes," he said, "bleeding. Probably hemorrhage. Lungs. And why in the world I didn't..."
"More likely he has cut or shot her," she said in a cold, quiet, bitter voice. "Though from the look in her eyes the one time I saw her close, I would have said she would be the one to do the cutting and shooting."
"Nonsense," he said, hunching into his suspenders. "Nonsense." Because he was not talking to her now, either.
"Yes, the fool. To bring her here, of all places. To sea level. To the Mississippi coast.
Do you want me to put out the lamp?"
"Yes. You'll probably be there a long time if you are going to wait until you are paid." He blew out the lamp and descended the stairs again behind the torch. His black bag sat on the hall table beside his hat. The man Harry still stood just without the front door.
"Maybe you better take this now," he said.
"What?" the doctor said. He paused, looking down, bringing the torch to bear on the single banknote in the other's extended hand. "Even if he has spent nothing, now he will have only $15, he thought.
"No, later," he said. "Maybe we had better hurry."
He bustled on ahead, following the torch's dancing beam, trotting while the other walked, across his own somewhat sheltered yard and through the dividing oleander hedge, and so into the full sweep of the unimpeded sea wind, which thrashed among the unseen palms and hissed in the harsh salt grass of the unkempt other lot. Now he could see a dim light in the other house.
"Bleeding, hey?" he said.
It was overcast.
The invisible wind blew strong and steady among the invisible palms from the invisible sea, a harsh, steady sound full of the murmur of surf on the outside barrier islands, the spits and scars of sand bastioned with tossing and shabby pines.
"Hemorrhage?"
"What?" the other said.
"Hemorrhage?"
"No," the doctor said.
"She's just coughing a little blood, then. Just spitting a little blood when she coughs, eh?"
"Spitting?" the other said. It was the tone, not the words. It was not addressed to the doctor, and it was beyond laughter. As if that which it addressed were impervious to laughter. It was not the doctor who stopped. The doctor still trotted onward on his short, sedentary legs behind the jolting torch beam toward the dim, waiting light. It was the Baptist, the provincial, who seemed to pause while the man, not the doctor now, thought not in shock but in a sort of despairing amazement. "Am I to live forever behind a barricade of perennial innocence like a chicken in a pen?" He spoke aloud, quite carefully. The veil was going now, dissolving now. It was about to part now, and now he did not want to see what was behind it. He knew that for the sake of his peace of mind forever afterward he did not dare, and he knew that it was too late now, and that he could not help himself. He heard his voice ask the question he did not want to ask, and get the answer he did not want to hear.
"You say she is bleeding. Where is she bleeding?"
"Where do women bleed?" the other said, cried in a harsh, exasperated voice, not stopping. "I'm no doctor. If I were, do you think I would waste $5 on you?" Nor did the doctor hear this either.
"Ah," he said, "yes, I see. Yes."
Now he stopped. He was aware of no cessation of motion since the steady dark wind still blew past him. "Because I am at the wrong age for this," he thought. "If I were 25, I could say, 'Thank God I am not him,' because I would know it was only my luck today, and that maybe tomorrow or next year it will be me, and so I will not need to envy him. And if I were 65, I could say, 'Thank God I am not him,' because then I would know I was too old for it to be possible. And so it would not do me any good to envy him, because he has proof on the body of love and of passion and of life that he is not dead. But now I am 48, and I did not think that I deserved this."
"Wait," he said. "Wait."
The other paused. They stood facing one another, leaning a little into the dark wind filled with the wild, dry sound of the palms.
"I offered to pay you," the other said. "Isn't five enough? And if it isn't, will you give me the name of someone who will come for that and let me use your telephone?"
"Wait," the doctor said.
So Kofor was right, he thought. "You are not married. Only why did you have to tell me so?" He didn't say that, of course. He said,
"You haven't. You are not. What are you?"
The other, taller, leaned in the hard wind, looking down at the doctor with that impatience, that seething restraint. In the black wind, the house, the shack, stood, itself invisible, the dim light shaped not by any door or window, but rather like a strip of dim and forlorn bunting, dingy and rigidly immobile in the wind.
"What am I what?" he said. "I'm trying to be a painter. Is that what you mean?"
"A painter? But there is no building, no boom, no development here anymore. That died 9 years ago."
"You mean you came here without any offer of work, any sort of contract at all?"
"I paint pictures," the other said. "At least, I think I do."
"Well, am I to use your phone or not?"
"You paint pictures," the doctor said. He spoke in that tone of quiet amazement which 30 minutes later and then tomorrow and tomorrow would vacillate among outrage and anger and despair.
"Well, she's probably still bleeding. Come along."
They went on. He entered the house first, even at the moment he realized that he had preceded the other not as a guest, not even as owner, but because he believed now that he alone of the two of them had any right to enter it at all, so long as the woman was in it. They were out of the wind now. It merely leaned, black, imponderable, and firm, against the door, which the man called Harry had closed behind them. And now, and at once, the doctor smelled again the odor of stale and cooling gumbo. He even knew where it would be. He could almost see it sitting, uneaten. They have not even tasted it, he thought. But why should they? Why in God's name should they? On the cold stove, since he knew the kitchen well, the broken stove, the spare cooking vessels, the meager collection of broken knives and forks and spoons, the drinking receptacles which had once contained gaudily labeled and machine-made pickle and jam. He knew the entire house well. He owned it. He had built it. The flimsy walls, they were not even tongue and groove like the one in which he lived, but were of shiplap, the synthetic joints of which, weathered and warped by the damp salt air, leaked all privacy, just as broken socks and trousers do. Murmurous with the ghosts of a thousand rented days and nights, to which he, though not his wife, had closed his eyes, insisting only that there be always an odd number in any mixed party which stayed there overnight, unless the couple were strangers formally professing to be man and wife, as now, even though he knew better, and knew that his wife knew better. Because this was it, this the anger and outrage which would alternate with the despair tomorrow and tomorrow. Why did you have to tell me, he thought. The others didn't tell me, upset me, didn't bring here what you brought, though I don't know what they might have taken away. At once he could see the dim lamplight beyond the open door. But he would have known which door without the light to guide him, the one beyond which the bed would be, the bed in which his wife said she would not ask a nigger servant to sleep. He could hear the other behind him, and he realized for the first time that the man called Harry was still barefoot, and that he was about to pass and enter the room first, thinking, the doctor, how he who actually had the only small portion of right to enter of either of them must hold back, feeling a dreadful desire to laugh, thinking, you see, I don't know the etiquette in these cases, because when I was young and lived in the cities where apparently such as this occurs, I suppose I was afraid, too afraid. Pausing because the other paused, so that it seemed to the doctor, in a steady, silent glare of what he was never to know was actual clairvoyance, that they had both paused as if to allow the shade, the shadow of the absent, outraged, rightful husband to precede them. It was a sound from within the room itself which moved them, the sound of a bottle against a glass. "Just a minute," the man named Harry said. He entered the room quickly. The doctor saw, flung across the beach chair, the faded jeans that were too small for her in exactly the right places. But he did not move. He just heard the swift passage of the man's bare feet on the floor, and then his voice, tense, not loud, quiet, quite gentle, so that suddenly the doctor believed he knew why there had been neither pain nor terror in the woman's face, that the man was carrying that too, just as he carried the firewood and, doubtless, cooked with it the food she ate. "No, Charlotte," he said, "you mustn't. You can't. Come back to bed now." "Why can't I?" the woman's voice said. "Why bloody can't I?" And now the doctor could hear them struggling. "Let me go, you bloody bungling bastard." It was rat, the noun, which the doctor believed he heard. "You promised, rat. That was all I asked, and you promised. Because, listen, rat." The doctor could hear it. The voice, cunning, secret now. "It wasn't him, you see. Not that bastard Wilborn. I ratted off on him like I did you.
It was the other one. You can't anyway. I'll plead my ass like they used to plead their bellies, and nobody ever knows just where the truth is about a whore to convict anybody.
The doctor could hear them, the two pairs of bare feet. It sounded as if they were dancing, furiously and infinitesimally and without shoes. Then he stopped, and the voice was not cunning, not secret. But where's the despair, the doctor thought. Where's the terror?
Jesus, there I went again. Harry, Harry, you promised. I've got you. It's all right. Come back to bed. Give me a drink.
No. I told you no more. I told you why not. Do you hurt bad now?
Jesus, I don't know. I can't tell. Give me the drink, Harry. Maybe that will start it again.
No, I can't now. It's too late for that, too. Besides, the doctor's here now. He'll start it again.
I'm going to put your gown on you so he can come in. And risk bloodying up the only nightgown I ever owned.
That's why. That's why we got the gown. Maybe that's all it will take to start it again. Come on now.
Then why the doctor? Why the $5? Oh, you damned bloody bungling. No, 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 no. Quick. There I go again. Stop me quick. I am hurting. I can't help it. Oh, damn bloody, bloody.
She began to laugh. It was hard laughing and not loud, like retching or coughing.
There, that's it. It's like dice. Come 7, come 11. Maybe if I can just keep on saying it.
He, the doctor, could hear them, the two pair of bare feet on the floor, then the rusty plaint of the bedsprings, the woman still laughing, not loud. Just with that abstract and furious despair which he had seen in her eyes over the bowl of gumbo at noon. He stood there, holding his little scuffed, worn, serviceable black bag, looking at the faded jeans among the wadded mass of other garments on the beach chair. He saw the man called Harry reappear and select from among them a nightgown and vanish again. The doctor looked at the chair.
Yes, he thought. Just like the firewood.
Then the man called Harry was standing in the door.
You can come in now, he said.